Okay, it seems like things are now fully in order, so if we can begin this meeting of the Standing Advisory Group, that'd be great. I'm Marty Bauman, Chief Auditor and Director of Professional Standards at the PCAOB, and I'd like to welcome everybody here today to the start of our two-day meeting. Hopefully we have a lively agenda, and we're looking forward to some outstanding input from the members of the SAG, as usual. This meeting, like all SAG meetings, is being webcast, so I'd also like to welcome those who are listening in. I'd also like to welcome Peggy Foran, who's not here, but will be participating by teleconference. And I'd also like to welcome everybody else in the room observing the meeting. Before we begin the meeting, I thought that I'd just spend a few minutes just going through the agenda for the next day and a half, just to give you a flavor of what we'll be doing. So if you can just take a quick look at the agenda. In a moment or two, I'll turn the microphone over to our acting chairman, Dan Gelzer, who'll give you an update on a variety of PCAOB matters. After that, I'll lead a discussion updating you on PCAOB standards setting activities, including activities over the last 12 months, including an update in terms of previous SAG discussions and where we are with respect to those items today, and then finally a discussion of the items that are on our standard setting agenda. That's going to be about an hour and a half set aside for that. One thing I will mention during that session, please raise your 10 cards at any time throughout that session to make a point on any item I'm discussing or any other point you'd like to make, rather than holding questions to the end. I'd like to make that discussion as interactive as possible. This first thing this afternoon, we're going to talk about the risk assessment standards. These 8 standards have been issued by the board, and they are will be final pending SEC review and finalization of them. This was a major project, and our goal here, and we've discussed it with the SAG during the project a number of times, but now that the standards have been adopted by the board, we thought it would be a good idea to ask Keith Wilson, who led the project, to go over some of the highlights of the standards and ways in which we think they've significantly or will significantly improve audit practice. So we'd like to just kind of review what we think we've accomplished in improving audit quality through those risk assessment standards. After that, two of our inspectors, deputy directors from our inspections division, will be speaking to you regarding a recently issued report of the board, a 4010 report on inspection observations regarding audits during the economic crisis. After that, we have a project on our standard setting agenda to reconsider the interim quality control standards. To some extent, the 4010 implies that improvements in firms' quality controls may be needed. Inspections have also identified situations where interactions by firms with their affiliates in their networks might be needed in terms of the quality controls. So there are a number of areas where we're looking at the interim quality control standards. Greg Skates will lead that discussion, and we'll be looking for SAG input on your views on designing and implementing a system of quality control. Tonight, dinner will be right across the street at the Madison Hotel with the reception beginning at 6:30. And we'll reconvene back here tomorrow morning at 8:30 with a continental breakfast available at 8 a.m. Our first topic tomorrow will deal with the recent standards proposed or issued by the FASB and or IASB and potential challenges to auditing that are raised by some of those standards. You may recall at the July SAG meeting, Larry Smith from the FASB joined us and talked about the number of projects on their agenda. That discussion largely focused around the pace and volume of change that was coming our direction. and there was a very lively discussion and some concern about that pace and volume expressed. We're going to dig down a little bit further in this discussion tomorrow and talk about some of the actual proposals that have come out and some of the implications that we see with respect to auditing challenges that those proposals present. We're also going to have a discussion on a recent release of the board, which included a concept release. The release dealt with the board's application of provisions of 105C6 of Sarbanes-Oxley entitled Failure to Supervise, and we included with that release a concept release about how we might go about implementing those provisions or how firms could implement their supervisory responsibilities and document those. We'll have a further discussion on that release and the related concept release tomorrow. And then the final item on the agenda is a summary of comments we received on our proposed standard on confirmations. We'll give a brief update again on some of the key provisions of that standard, as well as a lot of the comments we received back. With that, after that, we'll wrap up. So I think we have a very, very busy and interesting agenda over the next day and a half. Just as a reminder, once again, anytime anybody would like to speak, and that's usually quite often, please just raise your tent card on its side and we'll call on you. We'll typically call on you in the order in which the cards were raised, but we will try to see if somebody's interested in following up on a point that was made by somebody else, and to keep that discussion going whenever possible. Peggy, we won't be able to see your tent card, so you'll just have to let us know when you want to make a point. All right? One more housekeeping item. Over the next couple of days, several members of the staff will be addressing a variety of matters. When we're not talking about particularly addressing standards or particularly speaking specifically about a report that's been issued by the board, the comments we make will be our own views and will not necessarily reflect those of the board or individual board members. Likewise, just as a reminder, although SAG members may be employed or otherwise affiliated with particular organizations, we remind SAG members that they serve in their individual capacities and not as representatives of particular interests, groups, or employers. With that, that concludes my introductory comments. And before I turn the microphone over to Dan Gelser, does anybody have any comments or questions about the agenda or other matters? Seeing none, Dan, thank you.
Thanks very much, Marty. And I'd also like to welcome everyone to the October 2010 meeting of the PCAOB's Standing Advisory Group. I certainly appreciate everyone's willingness to be here and your willingness to take time from your schedules to assist the board in its standard setting and other activities. I know I'm looking forward to a day and a half of what I think will be very interesting and very valuable discussion. When this group met in July, the board had just received the Supreme Court's decision, which I would say in practical effect upheld our constitutionality. At least in my view, having survived a near-death experience, we've been fairly busy during the last 90 days. The activities of the Chief Auditor's Office alone, I think, could fill at least a half an hour of discussion. As Marty's already indicated, since July, the board has adopted 8 standards on risk assessment. We'll be talking about those later today. Issued a concept release on failure to supervise and its implications for our standard setting and for firms. And held a roundtable on a proposed standard on auditor audit committee communications. There's also been a considerable amount of behind-the-scenes activity in the standard setting area, laying the groundwork for other standards that will be seen the light of day either later this year or early next year. And again, I think Marty is going to comment on those. Since the work of our standard setting group will be covered in detail in Marty's comments, I'm not going to talk any further about that this morning. Instead, I wanted to just mention briefly developments in some other areas since the last meeting. I'm going to comment on five areas of PCOB activity. Some of these things reflect formal board action, others don't. I think perhaps I should give a disclaimer similar to the one that Marty did. Since board member views do vary on some of these topics, my comments will be solely my own. First, I want to talk about a legislative proposal that we made recently that would affect our enforcement program. In August, we asked Congress for legislation to amend the Sarbanes-Oxley Act to permit us to have public disciplinary proceedings. As I think perhaps many of you know, under the Sarbanes-Oxley Act today, the board's enforcement proceedings are non-public unless the board finds that there's good cause for a proceeding to be public and the parties to the proceeding consent to public proceedings. We've never had a public enforcement proceeding. The auditors or firms that we charge with violating the auditing standards or with other violations of our rules don't have much incentive to consent to public disciplinary proceedings. On the contrary, I think the fact that the proceedings are non-public often gives people an incentive to litigate. If nothing else, the fact that the proceedings aren't public will postpone the sort of the day of reckoning or the day of disclosure when the public learns about the charges that we've brought against a particular firm. I think that secrecy, while it may have been well intended originally, has a variety of unfortunate consequences for us. And most importantly, the people who are interested in our work, other auditors, public companies, certainly investors, users of financial statements, others are kept in the dark about what we are finding, or at least alleging, as violations that rise to a level of being the subject of disciplinary proceedings. There's a recent case that I think illustrates this phenomenon fairly well. It's about a month ago or a little bit more, the SEC issued its first written decision in a board disciplinary proceeding. That is a matter that was litigated by the PCOB, decided by the board, and then appealed to the SEC, and the SEC issued a decision. The case was called Gately. For present purposes, the facts aren't all that important, but the thing I'd like to indicate is that between the time that we brought our charges against Mr. Gately and his firm and the time that the SEC issued its decision, the firm issued an additional 29 audit opinions on public companies. It was, I believe, in a little less than a two-year period. Now, maybe all those clients would have chosen to use the same firm if they'd been aware of our charges. Maybe investors would have reacted the same way to those financial statements. I don't know, but at least I feel that the public should have had the benefit of that information so that they would have been aware of what was going on in our enforcement proceeding when those reports were issued. I would say, too, that I think the fact that our proceedings are non-public gives the public a sort of a distorted impression of what's going on in our enforcement program. The only cases people see are those that have been litigated all the way through the process or those that were settled at inception. However one might evaluate the program, if they had a full picture of it, I think people ought to have the full picture in order to understand what we're really doing. I sent a letter to the leadership of both the House and Senate committees that would have jurisdiction for the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, asking them to make this legislative change. I frankly don't know when or whether that might happen. I think from meetings that our staff has had with staff on the Hill, there is some interest in the proposal, but I can't make a prediction beyond that. I think I'll just end this topic by saying, since there isn't full transparency into it, I think we do have a very active enforcement program, perhaps a more active program than people realize. We don't, I guess, usually release statistics on the program, but maybe without getting in too much trouble, I can venture a few. In the first 6 months of this year, 20 additional formal order investigations were opened. About half involved large firms, about half involved small firms. There were 5 cases settled during that period. And there are a certain number of cases, which I guess I probably shouldn't say, that are being actively litigated by the office. So to me, at least, for a staff of 48 people, I think they're quite busy and quite active. Let me turn to a different topic, one that I've talked about in these presentations before, and that's our foreign inspection program. I think I've previously characterized the difficulties that we have in conducting inspections of firms that audit SEC registrants in some countries outside the United States as the biggest impediment that we face to fulfilling our statutory mission, and I'm afraid that I can't say that that's changed since the last time that I made the comment. Of course, some very important things have happened in the last 90 days since the last SAG meeting. For one thing, Congress passed the Dodd-Frank Act, which, along with its many, many other provisions, does give us the authority to share non-public inspections information with our foreign counterparts, that is, with audit oversight bodies in other countries. The original Sarbanes-Oxley Act did not give us that power, and it was something that I think was a sticking point, a point of concern to some of our non-U.S. colleagues, particularly in the European Union. So now we do have that ability. At about the same time, the European Commission and then the European Parliament issued a document called an adequacy determination with respect to the PCAOB. That's essentially a finding that we have an adequate system of auditor oversight, and it permits the member states in the EU to begin negotiations with us about our ability to conduct inspections in Europe. We are in various stages of negotiations with several of our European counterparts, but so far no agreements have actually been reached. It appears that the adequacy determination is more the end of the beginning rather than the beginning of the end in terms of our being able to resume inspections in Europe. We're still working through some tough issues with our European colleagues. Some relate to concerns generally about joint inspections with the PCAOB. Others relate to data protection. There are a host of issues. I don't think it's any secret that in at least some countries in Europe would prefer that we didn't conduct inspections, joint or otherwise, and simply relied on their home country audit oversight processes. We'll see what happens. Two other jurisdictions that if you look at our website, you'll see we're not able to conduct inspections in are Switzerland and China. We're in very active discussions with the Swiss, attempting to reach an agreement with them. I think there's some promise there, but again, we'll see what happens. And we have exchanged documents with the Chinese, but there's somewhat less progress on that front, although we're certainly actively trying to pursue it. Because of the uncertainties about when we'll be able to resolve these obstacles to foreign inspections, the board took another action affecting this area last week. We have become concerned about the fact that we continue to receive additional registration applications from firms in countries where we can't inspect. And so as we grant those applications and new firms register, the pool of firms that we can't inspect grows larger and larger. As a result of that, we stepped back and reevaluated our policy on registration of firms in jurisdictions where we can't inspect. And we announced last week that there would be a change in that area. Going forward, if we get an application from a firm that's based in a company, that's in a based in a country that's listed on our website as one where we can't inspect, we will not routinely approve that application. Instead, we'll ask the firm to confirm in writing that we can conduct an inspection, that there wouldn't be any obstacles, and to get concurrence in that fact from their regulator. If they can't provide us with that assurance, then we'll issue a notice of disapproval of that registration application. That means the application is disapproved, or alternatively, the firm could ask for a hearing on its application. Either way, a decision to disapprove a firm's application could ultimately result in an appeal to the SEC. I would say that we took this step, or at least from my personal perspective, I took this step with some reluctance. Certainly prefer to have an open registration system in which any firm anywhere in the world that wants to audit U.S. public companies and is prepared to live by the board's rules is free to register with us and come into our oversight system. But I think we simply came to a point, I at least came to a point, where I felt it just wasn't possible to continue registering firms that we can't inspect. Now, on this point, I should stress that this only affects new registration application. There's obviously already a significant number of firms registered with us in countries where we're currently unable to conduct inspections. We are giving thought as to what steps ought to be taken with respect to those firms. That could certainly include a variety of things, ranging from disclosure in their audit opinions of our inability to inspect them, or perhaps disclosure in the audit opinions of firms that rely on their work of the inability to inspect. It could include requirements where the firm has an affiliate in the United States, that possibly the work papers for the foreign audits have to be maintained in the United States, so we'll have some ability to look at the work. I think there are also other alternatives we could pursue. Of course, we do ultimately also have a power to bring enforcement actions against firms that don't cooperate in inspections. So I don't want to end this topic on a negative note. I just try to be optimistic, and I hope that these obstacles will be resolved and our inspection program, which is quite active in many countries around the world, will be able to get into these jurisdictions where we're currently not able to inspect. But again, I think we've come to feel that we're at a point where we have to begin taking concrete action when we can't conduct inspections. The third thing I'd like to flag, and I'll do it just briefly because it's later on the agenda, but is the fact that the board issued a report summarizing inspection observations coming out of audits of financial institutions and other issuers where we felt the work was affected by the economic crisis. The report was released about 2 weeks ago now, and it provides illustrative examples of audit deficiencies that our inspection program uncovered during the past 3 years as a result of the impact of the economic crisis on the work of auditors. As the report explains, the inspection staff did identify instances where they felt that the auditor hadn't complied with PCAOB standards in connection with audit areas that were affected by the crisis, discusses such things as auditing fair value determinations with respect to financial instruments, auditing impairment determinations, goodwill and other intangible assets, auditing loan loss determinations, off-balance sheet structures, revenue recognition, inventory valuation, income taxes, and a series of other issues. Again, there'll be a full discussion of this report later on the agenda today, and I won't try to say anything more about what's in it specifically or what its implications are. I will just say that, to me, the report shows that it doesn't show that audit failure caused the financial crisis or that better auditing would have prevented it. What I think it does show is that the major firms could do a better job in adjusting their procedures to addressing emerging audit risks as economic conditions change. I think the report also illustrates some of the very difficult challenges that auditors face in some areas as the accounting principles change and as there is room for more judgment in accounting. And again, I think we have a separate session on the agenda for this meeting to talk about some of the FASB's proposals currently before that board and their audit implications. Well, one of the things that I would like to accomplish, and I perhaps haven't done it as successfully as I would like to, is to see the board issue more reports of this type. We do have in our possession really a host of information about current auditing practice coming out of our inspection program. I think it's important that we make as much of that information as possible public so people will understand both what the challenges, the strengths and weaknesses in auditing practice are, so they have a better, and so that they will also have a better insight into the board's work. So I hope that we see more of those reports in the future. Fourth topic I'd like to mention, or give you a brief update on, or really perhaps more of a preview, is one that I think we also touched on in July, and that's the change in the board's responsibilities with respect to the auditors of broker-dealers, securities broker-dealers registered with the SEC. As I think you're probably all aware, the Dodd-Frank Act made a major change in our responsibilities by giving us authority to inspect, set standards for, and bring enforcement actions against the auditors of SEC-registered broker-dealers. Those firms had already been required to register with us, but we didn't have any other jurisdiction over their work. Now we have the same jurisdiction that we have over auditors of issuers. This will be a fairly significant change for us. There are about 5,500 broker-dealers registered with the SEC. We've picked up about 525 additional audit firms as a result of the requirement that those auditors register with us. And, of course, we had a significant number of firms registered with us already that were involved in broker-dealer auditing. Here are some of the projects that you'll probably see some evidence of publicly before the next SAG meeting that relate to our new broker-dealer responsibilities. First, we have to come up with funding rules and a funding methodology. The Dodd-Frank Act envisions that broker-dealers will pay the cost of board oversight of their auditors, and that is that the issuers won't be subsidizing our broker-dealer oversight. Broker-dealers are supposed to bear this cost in proportion to their net capital. I understand that about two-thirds of the net capital in the entire brokerage industry is concentrated in 20 firms, so our funding rules will also probably be quite heavily weighted towards the largest firms. I wouldn't expect that we would be imposing any substantial assessment on the smaller broker-dealers. We'll come out with a proposal in that area, hopefully before the end of this year, and we have to work out a methodology for allocating our costs internally to the broker-dealer oversight program. Second, I suppose the most importantly, we have to begin putting together an inspection program for these firms. I think the way we will do that is by adopting first a temporary inspection rule that encompasses all of the firms, so that next year we can conduct some inspections more aimed at giving us information about audit practice in this area rather than finding deficiencies in broker-dealer audits. Armed with that information, then, from what I would call the temporary inspection program, we'll be able to make some decisions about where we ought to really be devoting our resources in broker-dealer inspections, what we ought to be looking at, and I suppose most importantly, whether there are some broker-dealer firms that ought to be outside of our inspection program, which would, as the way the Dodd-Frank Act is written, have the effect of taking them outside of our registration program also. Obviously, many of these firms are very small, introducing firms, at least in theory, without access to customer assets, and I think we're going to have to think hard about exactly how we should be dealing with those firms and how they should apply to the system. I will say that this idea of a temporary information gathering inspections next year isn't one that the board is voted on yet. It is something that we've discussed, something that I personally think is a sound way to begin in this area. Broker-dealer responsibilities will also have a substantial impact on our standard-setting program. We'll be required to come up with auditing standards governing broker-dealer audits, and perhaps more importantly, the attest standards covering the compliance reports that broker-dealers have to file with the SEC and to which they are required to have their auditor attest. The SEC put out an interpretive release on this subject recently, basically telling people stick with the existing AICPA standards until the board issues its standards, which I think we would contemplate having by the end of next year. Finally, the last topic I'd like to touch on is our progress on the ACAP recommendations. I think at this meeting in April, we said that we would update the SAG periodically on that subject, and we have updated the written status report on the 13 PCOB-related ACAP recommendations that was distributed in April. I think that's available at the registration desk. There have not been really major changes in this area in the last 90 days. I will just flag briefly four things. ACAP recommended that we establish an academic fellow program to have better interchange between ourselves and other audit and accounting bodies and the academic community. That program is now up and running. Professor Michael Stein, professor of accounting at Old Dominion University in Norfolk, Virginia, joined the PCOB staff this summer as its inaugural fellow. He's working in our Office of Research and Analysis for the 2010-2011 academic year, and Professor Stein is currently hard at work helping ORA refine some of the risk models that we use in selecting engagements for inspection. Second thing I would note is that, of course, ACAP recommended that the board establish a center for the prevention and detection of financial reporting fraud. That's one of the recommendations that I think is particularly promising in terms of helping us accomplish our mission and fulfill our work. As I conceive it, the center would study the causes of particular financial reporting frauds, perhaps including by performing forensic analysis of specific cases, help in developing techniques and best practices for the prevention and detection of financial reporting fraud, commission research, conduct educational activities, and engage in other work aimed at preventing or reducing the incidence of fraud. I believe I said the last time I gave an update, we posted the position of a director for the Fraud Prevention Center. Got a gratifyingly large number of resumes. I think I said at the last meeting that I hope to address, to announce the first director of the center at this meeting. I'm afraid I won't be able to do that, but we are actively involved in interviewing candidates, and I'm excited about the Fraud Center finally getting off the ground. Third thing I'd mention is the ACAP recommendation that the board require engagement partners to sign audit reports in their own name, in addition to the name of the firm. The board issued a concept release, of course, on that subject last year. We discussed the topic with the SAG and more recently with our new investor advisory group. The board's consideration of that requirement is still pending. I say I'm personally very mindful of the importance of this recommendation to many investors and users of financial statements, and it certainly remains an active topic on our agenda. We have, of course, discussed this issue with our colleagues at the SEC, and I understand that the SEC staff is simultaneously considering a broader project that would explore the possibility of additional disclosure about the auditor and his or her work, including the identity of the engagement partner and perhaps of other audit team members. Brian Croteau from the SEC is here with us this morning. I wanted to ask Brian if he could say a couple of words about what the SEC has in mind in this area, the SEC staff.
Sure. Thanks very much, Dan. And I should start with a disclaimer similar to Marty's and Dan's, that the views I express today are my own and not necessarily those of the commission or other staff. That's a disclaimer that would also apply to Wayne, and at times even our views may differ. But it is true to Dan's point that the staff has been considering a project that has some overlap here. Certainly, Reg SX item 407 today already requires certain disclosures by audit committees about information such as whether the audit committee has a charter, whether they've reviewed and discussed the registrant's financial statements with management, whether the AU 380 required communications have occurred between the auditor and the audit committee, similar requirements with respect to whether the independence communications have occurred, and so on. The staff is giving consideration as to whether to suggest a project to the commission to seek comment on potential additional disclosures that audit committees could make with respect to the auditor's role and the audit committee's oversight over the auditor. Such disclosures, if they were made, could provide information that would be useful to both investors when they are voting to ratify independent public accounting firms, and also to public broadly in terms of assessing corporate governance areas. Some of the areas that we've been considering at the staff level, again, include information about the external auditor in terms of the demographics of the firm, specifics about the engagement team, potentially including the engagement partner, lead engagement partner name, and as well information about the audit committee's oversight over the auditor. So although we've begun discussions in this area, given the Dodd-Frank rulemaking that needs to occur. It is difficult to predict the exact timing in which the staff may make a recommendation to the commission, but certainly it's something we're giving consideration to. We recognize the importance of working together with the PCOB on this project and seeking public input along the way.
Thanks, Brian. But just the final ACAP topic that I'd like to mention is the recommendation that we rethink the basic auditor's reporting model, including the pass-fail opinion and whether and what form the auditor should communicate to shareholders, other users, additional information about the audit and the auditor's views on the financial statements. The board, of course, discussed this subject with the SAG recently, and it's also discussed it with its investor advisory group. And I think one thing that is crystal clear to all of us is that there is considerable hunger among investors and other users for more information from the auditor and more insight into the company's financial reporting. Based on those discussions, the reporting model has now moved as an important project onto our standard setting agenda. I would anticipate that this will be one of the things that we'll be spending a considerable amount of time and energy on next year. There are currently three initial milestones envisioned. First, the Office of the Chief Auditor is currently engaged in a sort of an information gathering exercise from published research and to some extent interviews and meetings with people that are interested or knowledgeable about this topic. The staff envisions that it will present its findings, conclusions, and recommendations to the board early next year. At least my proposal would be that occur at a public meeting. As I think I've said in some other contexts, sometimes I think a little too much of our standard setting occurs in private. Given the interest in this topic, I'm hoping that we can have that board staff discussion at a public session. That then would presumably lead to a concept release on changes that could be made to the auditor's reporting model, which would come out probably in the second quarter of next year, and then a roundtable on that topic in the middle of next year. Based on that information, then we would see specifically where we might be going with respect to any possible changes in the reporting model. That completes the overview that I wanted to give of things that have happened during the last 3 months or things that have been set in motion during the last 3 months that may happen before the next SAG meeting. I hope it's useful. It turned out to be a little bit longer than I had intended it to be. I'd certainly be happy to answer any questions if anybody has any. Otherwise, Marty is going to move into an overview of the standard setting activities specifically. Thank you very much.
Kevin Riley.
Dan, I know you met with your counterparts last month at the IFIAR meeting. One of the issues we talked about in July was the importance of a judgment framework for auditors and for preparers. And I know that we'll probably hear a lot about that tomorrow as well during the conversation on developing accounting and auditing standards. I thought that the issue of a judgment framework was raised at the IFIAR meeting last week. Any color commentary you can provide would be helpful, and specifically whether that issue is on your, you know, near-term to-do list from the PCAOB perspective.
Well, it was certainly raised, and I thought we had a very interesting discussion with the large firm representatives of the role that judgment plays in accounting determinations and auditing and certainly the importance that the firms attach to a judgment framework. And I guess I'll speak only for myself. My own feeling has been that this is a difficult area, an impractical area for the PCOB to proceed in initially. I think the CIFR recommendation that the judgment framework idea was based on looks to the SEC to adopt a framework with respect to how it evaluates accounting judgments. If the SEC were to have such a framework, then I think we would certainly have to give serious thought to how that framework impacts, for example, our inspection work and the way that we look at judgments that are made in the course of an audit about accounting determinations. And the other thing I would would say, and I made this point at the IFIAR meeting in Madrid, is that the CIFAR report really itself provides to some extent a judgment framework. It contains a list of factors that the authors of that report thought should be taken into account in reaching a judgment. In fact, I think I've seen quoted somewhere that CorpFin may sometimes use those factors as when it gets into dialogue with registrants about accounting judgments. So I guess I'm to the extent it were my determination, and it is, I think, more an accounting determination than an auditing one, I'm not sure whether much more is needed than what CIFAR's already provided to us.
Galen Hansen.
Thanks, Dan. I do have one question and then a comment. In the area of firm registrations, I think it's great what the board has done here in the last week to really sort of tighten the screws on the new applications. And I'm not sure what the possibilities in this area are, but it seems to me like the new registrations that are going to come before the board are more than likely going to be smaller firms. And with that in mind, and given what are those possibilities, cannot the current registrants also be considered? And what is the status of those registrations? Because it seems to me like we're sort of catching the tail end of the problem rather than the bulk of the problem. And I do think that looking at that audit report or whatever other disclosures to put the investor on notice that, these firms have not been inspected, and, investor beware, at least at a minimum, needs to be considered, and I think you had mentioned that. And then just switching topics, back on the public discipline matter, the legislative matter that is being pursued, the comments that I've gotten just from professionals that I rub elbows with at what point are we in investigation and at what point are we in enforcement? Because the perception is that in this role you're going to be, you're not innocent until proven guilty. So I don't know if that's really been communicated particularly very well. There's a lack of clarity as to where that spectrum is. Maybe you might be able to comment on that.
Well, yeah, let me take the second one first. I think for us there's a very sharp distinction between are you being investigated or is there a proceeding against you. I mean, for those in the room who've been at the SEC, and we essentially have the same parallel system to what they have with a system of investigations based on formal orders of investigation, and then the staff making a determination about whether a case should be brought and the board having to vote on that. And we're not suggesting at all that the investigatory process become public. And as at the SEC, that would certainly remain non-public. The thing that would trigger a public proceeding would be the staff recommendation to the board that a case be brought and then a board determination to bring that case. And again, I don't mean to suggest in any of this that all charges that we bring are necessarily valid or ultimately going to be found to be valid, but there is a considerable amount of, often a period of months, sometimes years, investigatory work that goes into making an enforcement recommendation. So they are not at all brought casually or without substantial thought as to whether the charges can be sustained in litigation. And the part about the firm registrations, well, I guess I can only say I agree with you completely. I mean, obviously, we are well aware that most of the foreign firms are already registered with us. And as I tried to say in my comments, this action we took last week does not in itself affect those firms that are already registered. But, I mean, the point about disclosure, for example, and audit opinions is something that we are giving very serious thought to, and I think you're likely to see proposals in that area, or perhaps the area of bringing work papers into the United States when we can't conduct the foreign inspection, or something very much on our mind. And the other The other thing I'd say as well, I think your point is right, that this, at least immediately, is going to have a bigger impact on small non-U.S. firms. At least to my understanding, that the large firms do sometimes reorganize their practices outside the United States, and that sometimes triggers a need to register a new firm with us. So they, large firms may eventually feel some bite from this proposal also.
Barbara Roper? On the same topic, I went and read the EU decision, and I actually think there's a lot of cause for concern in that decision that we aren't really, that the progress that it appears to offer is ephemeral or illusory. It sunsets in 2013. The joint inspections are only allowed under exceptional circumstances. It's viewed as a route toward mutual recognition, not a long-term program of joint inspections, as I can see it. So, I mean, I do just think it reinforces the need to start looking at some of the types of things you've discussed, like having the work papers here, maybe having enhanced supervisory responsibilities, because it's not clear to me that this is a step toward a long-term solution to this problem.
Barbara, I think I can only say that I agree with everything you've said. I would say, I think if you want to take the slightly more optimistic view, we think the determination leaves a lot of room for interpretation by individual member states. And at this point, I think it's just not clear how flexibly it'll be interpreted. As I did say earlier, and the bottom line is we haven't struck any agreements with anyone yet.
Damon Silvers.
Two things, Dan. One, first, I think like a couple other people have commented. I think that both these major initiatives on the board's part with respect to foreign inspections and with respect to the enforcement process are welcome. And I really want to commend you for stepping forward on these things. They've sort of been hanging out there for many years. I think you and the board and the staff deserve a lot of credit. Secondly, and I don't know whether this is appropriate for this time or whether you want to take it up during the inspection observations on the economic crisis, but it seems to me that this week there's a number of obvious audit issues raised by developments in the mortgage markets, which I would like to discuss. You tell me when.
Well, it might go better with the 4010 report, if you don't mind.
It's fine with me.
Appreciate your comments, however.
Lynn Turner.
Dan, I'd just like to commend you for your leadership in this area of the foreign inspections and trying to get the enforcement proceedings public. I think under your leadership, the board has done more in the last year than it's done in the previous 8 years of existence, and I think that is a tremendous kudo both to you and your fellow board members. I know these are difficult issues, so I think the direction you're headed in is absolutely correct and very critical to investor protection. I do have a couple questions for you. On the issue on making the enforcement proceedings public. Of course, both you and I were at the commission when the SEC adopted that with the bipartisan support of all the commissioners to have these proceedings public. Are you receiving any opposition from the firms up on the Hill on that issue? I'd be interested in knowing that. On the foreign inspections, you mentioned you're dealing with the Swiss. I would expect it would be very difficult to negotiate such agreements with France and Germany along the lines of what Barb said in terms of joint inspections versus mutual recognition. With respect to the four largest markets in Europe, Spain, Europe, Germany, France, and the UK. Have you been able to make any substantive progress on negotiating agreements with those four? And then the last point is you mentioned getting access and oversight over the auditors of broker-dealers. I know the SEC has been pushing Congress to get greater jurisdiction over the municipal markets because of what a number of people consider to be pending problems in those markets and perhaps some systemic problems there. Have you considered teaming up with the SEC there to also ask for oversight over the auditors of municipal securities? Those are the three questions. Just one last point, too. I would also note that I think it would, just in the last week, I've gone out to one of the largest institutional investors in the country and had a discussion about with them about your inspections. And they didn't realize the problems that you've got with foreign, being able to inspect foreign audits. I think there's an assumption that you guys were inspecting all this. I would be very supportive from a transparency perspective, for especially for investors, if you guys would include a requirement in the audit report for the auditor to say if you were unable to inspect affiliates or audits where part of the work was done outside the U.S. And as a result, we don't have the same degree of confidence we have here for the ones you could inspect. I think it'd be very informative and useful for investors to put them on notice and require that they be put on notice in the audit report.
Hey, thanks for your comments, Leonard. I appreciate them very much. In terms of opposition to the proposal to make the enforcement proceedings public, I have heard of none. I'm not aware that anyone has taken a public position against the proposal. I guess I'm not aware that anyone's taken a public position, or any organizations at least have taken a public position in favor of it. Obviously, I have sort of no way of knowing what back channel communication there might be.
Have the firms public or privately told you that they oppose that?
Certainly, no one's told me that, at least. I think the answer is no. I guess I'm a little reluctant to get into details of negotiations with particular countries in the EU. I think it's safe to say that we are not near an agreement with any of the jurisdictions you mentioned. I'll leave it at that. In terms of oversight of municipal securities auditors, I'm aware of some of the problems in that market. It is not something that we've discussed with our colleagues at the SEC. It's certainly something to consider.
Thanks, Dan. Oh. And, oops, sorry. There's another one down there. Jeff Mahoney, sorry.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, you might have just answered this, but with respect to the negotiations, can you give us any flavor at all as to the types of concessions that are being asked for or considered?
Well, I mean, let me just speak at a very general level, because I really don't want to impact negotiations with any particular country. There are concerns about data protection, which I understand it could translate into a suggestion that anybody whose name is mentioned in our inspection files somewhere would have some sort of a right to see that information and contest it. That would be a serious problem for us. There is interest on the part of some countries in being able to have at least input into what's in our inspection report on firms in their jurisdiction. That's certainly something of a problem for us. Obviously, we ultimately have to make the determinations about the reports. That's, I guess, that would give a flavor at least of the kinds of things that are a concern. I mean, Barbara quoted correctly the statements in the determination about joint inspections being kind of a, unusual or an exception, and I think there are some jurisdictions that would prefer that we not conduct joint inspections in their territory at all. Thank you. I think I'm done, Marty. Thanks.
Okay. Now I can say thanks for passing it back to me, and thanks everybody else for all of your comments and important observations on the matters that Dan discussed. We appreciate all that input. The next topic we're going to discuss are developments in standard setting in the Office of the Chief Auditor. During this discussion, I'll be making reference to three documents that are in your folders. So you can find these documents now. They're in the left pocket of your folder, about halfway in. One is entitled PCAOB Standard Setting Activities, October 2009 to October 2010. That's a two-page document. The second document is entitled Status of Previous SAG Standard Setting Discussion Topics. Again, it's in the left pocket of your folder, about halfway through. And the next one is kind of a landscape presentation that says Office of the Chief Auditor Standard Setting Agenda. These were also posted today to our website, so for those listening in, you can access them on the web. So hopefully everybody has these documents. I'll just pause for one more minute I see Kevin searching to try to find them. We buried them, so so only an auditor could find them, right, Sam? I'll be making reference to these throughout this presentation. Again, I would like to repeat what I said earlier. Please feel free, and I encourage you to raise your tent card throughout this session, as I'm covering a variety of different topics, and I think it would be beneficial to all if you have questions and observations to make them at the particular point in time rather than waiting to the end, although certainly we'll have a discussion at the end also. So the first topic I'm going to address very briefly is the PCAOB standard setting activities October 2009 to 2010. This document summarizes for you adopted or proposed standards or other auditing guidance issued over the past year. As you can see in the beginning of the first of this document, and as Dan has already made reference to, this year we adopted 8 new auditing standards, which we collectively refer to as the risk assessment standards. This is really a large project. It was a major effort. This represents the culmination, subject to SEC final approval, of this major standard-setting effort. The standards include critical aspects of planning an audit, supervising it, assessing materiality in planning and performing the audit, identifying and assessing risks in an audit and responding to those risks, the auditor's evaluation of audit results and audit evidence. So they do deal with the fundamental aspects of the audit. We also think investors will be well served by the improved integration throughout the risk assessment standards of fraud risk assessments rather than sort of as fraud sat sort of alone in old SAS 99, auditing standard 316 on fraud. These standards largely integrated key elements of considerations of fraud throughout the process, which we think should have significant impact on fraud risk. So again, we've discussed, as I mentioned earlier, these standards with the SAG before. Because of the importance of these standards, we will be making a presentation of the highlights of what we think the most important aspects are on these after lunch. Just moving down the list, we proposed auditing standards pertaining to communications with audit committees and amended various other standards. We received comments on that, and based on those comments, we held a roundtable, of which a number of people here participated in that roundtable, and we reopened the comment period through October 21st, 2010. This standard, we believe, and I'll talk a little bit more about it on the agenda, has some very important aspects. And although a lot of issues were discussed at the roundtable, one thing that was clear was the importance of auditor communications with the audit committee, and we'll focus on that importance as we reconsider the next steps in the standard. The next proposed standard was with respect to confirmations. Again, a very important audit procedure. And in that proposal, we did make more robust requirements surrounding the use of confirmations in audits. Again, because of the importance of this standard, we're going to have a presentation as part of this agenda tomorrow, which will go over, again, the proposal and some of the key comments that we've received. Page two. As I previously mentioned, we issued a release related to failure to supervise and solicited comments on rulemaking concepts with respect to that provision. That comment period is still open, and we're going to use this SAG meeting as an opportunity for people to make comments about that rulemaking concept, and that item is on our agenda this afternoon. We issued two important staff practice alerts during this year as well. One dealt with audit considerations regarding significant and unusual transactions. We were led to issue that practice alert based upon certain observations we'd seen regarding how some companies structured certain transactions, and companies at times can structure transactions in a way in which the economic substance might not be exact as to what the form of the transaction is. So auditors have responsibilities with respect to identifying, auditing, communicating significant and unusual transactions, and this practice alert was intended to remind auditors of their responsibilities in this regard. Another practice alert we issued was practice alert 6, on audit considerations regarding using the work of other auditors and engaging assistance from outside the firm. As we had discussed at a SAG meeting before issuing this practice alert, the practice was observed where through a variety of reverse mergers and other vehicles, businesses that largely had their operations almost virtually completely outside the United States were receiving audit reports from firms in the United States who were not following appropriate standards either with respect to supervision in the audit, AU 311, or using the work of other auditors in AU 543, and were issuing audit reports not in accordance with PCOB standards in these situations. So again, this practice alert was intended to remind auditors of their responsibilities here. And this was a significant problem with a number of reverse mergers and reports that we think were inappropriately issued. Hopefully this will, to some extent, remind auditors of their proper responsibilities in this area. And the last item was a Q&A on Auditing Standard 7, Engagement Quality Review, to clarify one aspect of that standard. In summary, I think we had a very active year with respect to standard setting, proposals, and other guidance, in addition to the many, many items that we're working on a regular basis on our standard setting agenda that I'll go over in just a moment. The next document that I'd like to briefly cover is the status of previous SAG standard setting discussion topics. When I reached out to SAG members for advice about a year ago or so, many SAG members indicated that they had participated in discussions throughout the years, but it wasn't always clear as to what was happening with that particular discussion, where it went. So what we've decided to do is make a document that's really an accounting, if you will, for discussion dates when we had a discussion topic, what the topic was, and what the status of that is. So this is organized by most recent topic first, down to the earliest topics last. I'll very briefly go through this, but again, please to respond to any questions or comments throughout it. FASB, IASB projects and potential challenges, standard setting is under consideration, and again, we're looking for SAG input on the impact of this FASB actions and the changed, large degree of the change in the accounting frameworks potentially, and the impact on auditors and maybe the need for additional auditing standards. Dan's already referred to our broker-dealer audit considerations, and that is a current standard-setting project. Auditor's responsibilities to subsequent events is a current standard-setting project. The auditor's reporting model, a current standard-setting project. I'll go through these current standard-setting projects in substantially greater detail when I go through our standard-setting agenda in a few moments. Responsibilities of the principal auditor, again, Practice Alert 6 dealt with that to some degree, and it's also a current standard-setting project. The same with the next two items, fair value measurements and the use of specialists, are current standard-setting projects. Communications with audit committees, I've already updated you. Related parties is a current standard-setting project, as is confirmations below that. Engagement quality review, as you're aware, we published and is now effective for audits in 2010, AS7 on engagement quality reviews, which standard we think will significantly improve audit practice. Going concern, a current standard-setting project. Audit considerations in the current economic environment is a topic, and we published Staff Practice Alert 3 to help guide auditors about the risks in the current economic environment. One discussion we had with the SAG was regarding an ACAP recommendation on feasibility of the PCAOB identifying audit quality indicators and then possibly the requirement for firms to disclose something with respect to those audit quality indicators. We've had a number of discussions, including, as I said, a discussion with the SAG back in October 2008. While not a current standard-setting project, we are, as the footnote indicates, monitoring closely the work of others in this area, such as IOSCO and the IAASB, as indicated they have a project on this as well. So we'll continue to monitor efforts of others as we consider what direction to take on this particular item. Dan's already commented on signing the auditor's report, and I've already commented on auditor's responsibility to supervise and our current release we have out on that. A discussion was held on page 3 of this with respect to the proposal relating to a judgment framework, the CIFER recommendation, and as Dan indicated, that is under consideration, but we're also considering that as to the extent the SEC makes recommendations in that regard. Quality controls, as I mentioned, is a current standard setting project, and that's on our agenda during this session. Audit implications of IFRS statements in U.S. SEC filings. It indicates pending review of interim standards. As we update any interim standard, and we have a number of proposals in place, we are making sure that our references to U.S. GAAP are changed and our standards are intended to be framework neutral. So this will sort of continue to be updated on a regular basis to make our standards framework neutral. But in addition to that, as we identify particular issues in IFRS that may not exist in GAAP, we may consider other standard-setting projects pertaining to that. And then, of course, any decision by the SEC with respect to the adoption of IFRS might impact our standard-setting activities in that regard as well. So there's a number of ways in which our standard-setting projects could be impacted with respect to IFRS. Some years ago, a discussion was held about engagement team performance, and that's being addressed through various projects that we have that address responsibilities, supervision of the engagement team, et cetera. But that'll be ongoing. Forensic audit procedures were discussed with the SAG, and there is no current standard-setting project on forensic audit procedures. Implementation of 404 resulted in AS5, as you're all aware. The last item on this page, indemnification and limitation of liability clauses, is not a current standard-setting project. Page 4, risk assessment standards we've discussed have been adopted. Principles of reporting are reflected in AS number 6. Reasonable assurance, not pending review of interim standards, but to some degree this item could potentially be covered in the auditor's reporting model, which we'll talk about in a much broader sense, a variety of changes, which could consider clarification of what reasonable assurance means. Codification of standards. This is mentioned to us in a number of comment letters. Right now we sort of have two bodies of literature. What was adopted as part of the interim standards, the AU references, and then recently adopted standards, which number from AS1 through now AS15, and which are not, except the risk assessment standards, although they're organized logically from AS8 through AS15, not integrated with respect to other aspects of the interim standards that are in place. This is an important consideration of ours in terms of how we're going to deal with this. To a large degree, we think the most important thing for us is to deal with the very many projects that we intend to propose standards on over the next couple of years, in which I'll be reviewing momentarily. But at the same time, we do have our staff considering how we might codify new standards with interim standards until they're, you know, we finally adopt all interim standards as, quote, final standards. This is a complicated consideration because the interim standards, anytime we would try to adopt them as a final standard, it would be a rulemaking activity that would open up the interim standard for comment. So it's not simply a matter of trying to blend them all together. It's a much more complicated process than that. So we're listening to people about the importance of this matter, considering ways to deal with it, and we suspect we'll get back to the SAG on this further discussion in the near term. Gas hierarchy was discussed some time ago, and not doing anything particularly with that at this point in time. AS4 dealt with reporting and material weaknesses. Fraud and related topics are very important, and as I indicated with respect to risk assessment, we think dealt with throughout the risk assessment standards as they incorporate fraud concepts throughout. We think that's a superior approach to build our concepts of risk of fraud into each of our standard-setting projects rather than one standard that deals just with fraud, and which our inspectors have noted kind of allows the audit teams to think of fraud potentially one time when they have a brainstorming session or something at the beginning of an audit, and oftentimes don't integrate those processes into the audit. So what we're doing is integrating fraud risk concerns and approaches into each standard that we propose. The auditor's responsibility for communications to investors containing financial information. So this would be other financial information, press releases, and things of that nature. Some have commented that some of the most important communications to investors are in the press release, which really drives the market more than, and the price of a stock, more than the ultimate 10K does. We've had discussions with this, with the investor advisory group pointed this out, and we're aware, of course, of the importance of other financial communications that are not the financial statements covered by an auditor's report. We don't have a standard set project particularly on this matter, but we have it. We're well aware of the importance of this. To some extent, it's possible the discussion of the auditor's reporting model might have, in the concert release, some aspects of how this could be played into auditor's reporting. So at this point in time, though, that's not a current standard-setting project. So with that, that's a review of every discussion topic that we've had as official standard-setting projects that we've brought to the SAG and where they stand. And as you can see, by and large, we've either adopted a standard, proposed a standard, or we have the matter as a current standard setting item on our agenda. So the next item I'd like to discuss with you is this landscaped document called the Office of the Chief Auditor Standard Setting Agenda. The top two pages of the agenda are important because they include a discussion of factors that drive our standard setting agenda. These points are summarized on this slide that we've just put up. Matters get onto our standard setting agenda based on how we and the board identify priorities. The staff makes recommendations and discusses these items with the board. The board often gives us direction as to items they believe should be on our agenda as well. Identification of risks in audits and needed improvements to existing standards and to audit quality initially drive that prioritization. That is then significantly informed by the results of PCAOB inspections and other factors. Environmental factors are an important element of such other factors. First, and as I've mentioned, financial reporting fraud continues to be a major concern of investors, and reports of fraud can shake investor confidence in the reliability of financial statements and in the reliability of audit reports. As such, the risk of material misstatement due to fraud permeates each of our standard setting projects. And as I indicated, in each project, we consider the risk of fraud and, as appropriate, incorporate audit requirements to address that risk in that particular area. The current standard setting agenda has also been significantly influenced by the economic downturn and the disruption in the credit markets. For example, as Dan has indicated, issues identified through the inspection of audits conducted during the economic crisis indicate that there's a need for the board to address certain of its standards, including, among others, audit firm quality controls, audits of fair value measurements, and the use of specialists by auditors, for example, of items that would be identified as needing improvement based upon issues identified during audits during the crisis. And the direction we go in those standards will reflect the inspection observations in that regard. Another factor being considered is the inability, as again was discussed by Dan, of the PCAOB to carry out required inspections of certain accounting firms outside the United States. Again, our standard setting projects will consider this factor, and as some have already mentioned, whether that's included in audit reports, the identification of firms, or other matters, we'll consider as we're developing our standard setting projects on the auditor's reporting model, for example, the use of other auditors outside the United States, and therefore auditors' responsibility with respect to the use of other auditors, especially in the context if they're not inspected, and procedures that might be necessary in that regard, therefore, and other standard-setting projects such as quality controls, and quality controls a firm might need to have if, in fact, they're relying on work of affiliates who are not subject to PCAOB inspections. So matters such as environmental factors identified during the economic crisis and challenges with respect to inspecting firms can also impact the direction of our standards. One other matter I'll mention, and although we don't presently have a project on our agenda related to auditor independence, my office is working closely with Division of Registration and Inspections monitoring non-audit services being performed by accounting firms, particularly with respect to audit clients, to identify whether or not additional rulemaking is needed in that area. Our standard setting agenda is also significantly informed, of course, by advice from the SAG, work of other standard setters, and discussions that we have with the SEC. In summary, I think we have a very ambitious agenda, yet appropriate, that's responsive to the inputs that I just described. One last item I just want to mention before I turn to the agenda itself. As you look at the standard setting agenda, the numbering of a particular item on the agenda has no impact or no meaning with respect to the priority of that item on the agenda. They've simply basically got on the agenda in a certain order, and that's the numbering. The priority is reflected by the fact that the item is on the agenda and the pace with which we plan to address that item. And those would be matters that we'd be interested in your views on, the pace with which we expect to deal with the item. So with that, we'll turn to the various different items that are on the standard setting agenda on beginning on page 3. And of course, I've mentioned numerous times already the risk assessment standards, which were adopted by the board on August 5th. They've been published in the Federal Register by the SEC, and they are now pending SEC final approval. And pending that approval, those standards are intended to be effective for audits beginning after December 15th, 2010. With respect to communications with audit committees, the second item on page 3, the standard was proposed in March of 2010. Comments received were generally supportive of the standard and the need to make revisions to the existing standard, but suggested additional outreach. So in that regard, we held a roundtable in September, largely to get additional input from audit committee members about what audit committee members believed they should be receiving in terms of communications from auditors. And then reopened the comment period until October 21st. We greatly appreciated the input that we received from those who participated in that roundtable. And although we heard a number of differing views and perspectives, one thing was absolutely crystal clear, and that was the critical importance to the audit process of high-quality communications between auditors and the audit committee. Our goal with any reproposed or final standard here will be to further enhance investor protection by requiring critical matters to be communicated by the auditor to the audit committee in such areas such as including the establishment of an understanding of the terms of the audit with the audit committee rather than with management, requiring a discussion of the audit strategy with the audit committee, including the auditor's assessment of significant risks that will be addressed as part of the audit, and getting the audit committee's feedback on their view on those significant risks, a process we think will greatly improve risk assessment and the agreement on major areas to be addressed as part of the audit. Strengthening the discussion of critical accounting policies, practices, and estimates as part of the communications. Discussing any complaints or concerns raised regarding accounting or auditing matters both ways. We think the audit committee, or one item being considered in this, is for any matters that are raised to the auditor via any channel whatsoever, including their younger staff, employees of the company, whatever it might be, to discuss those complaints or concerns with the audit committee, but also frequently audit committees have hotlines or tip lines, et cetera, and those matters should be discussed, should be raised to the auditors for discussion as well, so the auditors can consider those matters. So there's a number of very important items that we think will be in one way or another an element of whatever standard we repropose or adopt. And again, we're taking carefully into consideration the matters that came up as part of the roundtable and matters that may yet come up as part of the opening of discussions through October 21st. Again, so if there are no comments on that one, we plan to repropose or adopt a final standard in the first quarter of 2011. The next item on the agenda deals with confirmations. This standard was proposed in July, and the comment period closed on September 13th. This is, as I mentioned earlier in my comments, we think confirmations are a very important element of the audit process. Our proposal did strengthen and expand the use of confirmations to a number of additional areas where they are not already required by the current standard, and we received a number of comments on that. We'll be discussing and summarizing all of the comments in this area for the SAG tomorrow, and we can have further discussion around this item. But our goal is to repropose or adopt as a final standard in the second quarter of 2011. The next item is number four, signing of the audit report by the engagement partner in addition to signing the firm name. And as Dan mentioned, the board is still considering next steps with respect to this particular standard setting item. In August, on number five here, the board issued a release related to the application of the provisions in Sarbanes-Oxley of 105C6, or failure to supervise, and also solicited comments on related rulemaking concepts. The comment period on this release is still open until November 3rd. We'll discuss this item with the SAG tomorrow morning and look for your comments. We'll also give further discussion about what our intent was with respect to this particular release and the related concept release with it. We'll analyze comments received on this concept release, and our goal is to present them to the board so that the board consider its next steps on this item before the end of this year. With respect to related parties, we plan to issue a proposed standard to amend the existing interim standards in the first quarter of 2011. Key aspects of this standard-setting project include strengthening the requirements related to the auditor's evaluation of material related party transactions, one. Secondly, the auditor to assess the risks associated with relationships with executive officers, for example, executive compensation that may create incentives for fraud. And a third area, improving the auditor's response to the risk of undisclosed related party transactions. We're also considering whether to propose additional audit requirements pertaining to the auditor's identification and examination of significant or unusual transactions outside the ordinary course of business as part of this project. As I mentioned earlier, of course, a practice alert was issued in this regard several months ago. The next project on our list deals with the use of specialists. This project is a very high priority item, and we're hoping to propose a new standard this quarter. The use of specialists can be a very important part of any audit, and clearly was so with respect to the determination of fair values and other matters during audits during the economic crisis. How auditors used the work of specialists, supervised them, and evaluated their work resulted in numerous inspections findings. Today, there's really quite a mix of guidance here that needs to be addressed. For instance, internal specialists or specialists employed by an audit firm are governed by one standard, and that is at AU 311 on supervision, whereby third-party specialists who are engaged by the auditor are governed by a different standard under AU 336. So essentially, two firms could have essentially the same role being performed. One firm could hire the specialist and have them on their staff. Another firm may engage a specialist, a third party. Those specialists may be doing the exact same things with respect to particular audits, but their responsibilities now are governed by two different auditing standards, which have different performance requirements as well. Also, management frequently uses specialists to support their particular their audit evidence, and they're governed by AU 336. So again, as I said, there are performance differences between the standards, and the structure of the standards is quite complex and confusing. It needs to be fixed. There are also certain provisions in the specialist standard that may be too vague, such as in AU 336, the phrase, quote, the auditor should, quote, obtain an understanding, close quote, of the specialist work. That obtaining of an understanding may be too vague and may be in need of additional clarification as to what the standard intends. Also, there are provisions in the specialist standard that may be too permissive, such as, and I'll quote, ordinarily, the auditor would use the work of a specialist unless the auditor's procedures lead him or her to believe the findings are unreasonable, close quote. It may be more appropriate to require that the auditor perform specific procedures to determine that the work is reasonable, simply not accept the work so long as it's not unreasonable. So these are many of the key aspects of the provisions of the standards themselves, the structure of the standards regarding two different standards, really dealing with the same types of areas of supervision, but yet in two different approaches with two different performance obligations. We're working very closely with our inspections division and their observations with respect to the use of specialists as we develop these standards in what I'll call a complicated area of standard setting, and where we've spent a lot of time, and again, as I indicated, hope to propose standards for public comment this quarter. Dennis Bassford.
This may not be entirely on point, but in just sort of glancing through the rest of the agenda, is SAS 70 type reporting something that the PCAOB deals with? I know there's been a lot of discussion about that topic lately. The AICPA apparently is in the process of redoing its guidelines. Is that not part of the PCAOB's responsibility, or is it, and it's just not on the agenda at this point, or could you tell me where that stands?
Good question. And just for the benefit of some others who may not have SAS 70 on the tip of their tongues, it deals with the audits of service organizations where an auditor either performs that audit of a service organization or who's performing procedures for an issuer, or where an auditor might use the results of an auditor, another auditor's review of that service organization as they consider their audit of an issuer and how that issuer is using a service organization. As you've indicated, certainly in any audit of an issuer, in many audits of issuers, there are service organizations and auditors are reviewing SAS 70 reports that other auditors are performing to determine how to use that work and whether to use that work as audit evidence and to use the work of the service auditor. We are aware that other standard setters are looking at that. In fact, when we reached out for comments, as we frequently do to SAG members as to things to look at, a couple of members of the SAG indicated they thought this was something that we should look at. So your question is on point. We have that item as a matter to consider, and what we should be doing with that. But we have not added it to our standard setting agenda at this time. But it is an important matter, and it's a project of ours, but not yet elevated to the standard setting agenda. The next project that's on here deals with auditing fair value measurements and other accounting estimates. Auditing fair values is another area where, as Dan mentioned again earlier, where inspections has had numerous findings, including the observations that were mentioned in the 4010 report on audits inspected during the economic crisis. Auditing of fair values has received a lot of attention from my office over the last couple of years, being the subjects of practice alert number 2, which was entitled Considerations in Auditing Fair Values, practice alert 4, which specifically dealt with fair values, and we put that guidance out after the FASB had put out some clarifications regarding FAS 157 on fair values. And then practice alert 3 as well, which dealt with audit considerations in the current economic environment, which largely had risks pertaining to fair values there also. So we have been putting out guidance quite regularly to remind auditors of their responsibilities with respect to audits of fair value measurements. Having said that, it's an area, given the number of amount of guidance we've put out and the number of observations that have come out of inspection findings, where we believe that additional standard setting is needed. We had targeted issuance of a proposed new auditing standard in this regard in 2010, but had deferred that now until the second quarter of 2011 for a number of reasons, one at least being some of the challenges in this area as we're developing a proposed standard. But also another important reason was the consideration by the FASB of a variety of changes to both fair value accounting standard, which would greatly increase the use of fair values, including the proposed standard on financial instruments, for example, that would include fair loans to be required to be recorded at fair values, and many of those loans don't trade. So again, that we would take that into consideration in terms of what I'll call the complexity of auditing fair values, where the fair values are not quite observable. And also, FASB is considering some changes itself to the fair value standard, the definition of fair value. So we're taking those considerations into account as well. So we've deferred our proposal on this to the second quarter of 2011. A number of issues will be addressed in this standard setting project, including we have at least 2 standards directly on point in fair value, and the interaction of these 2 standards. AU 328 is entitled Auditing Fair Values. AU 332 is entitled Auditing Derivative Instruments, Hedging Activities, and Investments in Securities. So these 2 standards both have a variety of concepts with respect to auditing of fair values, and how those standards interact will be an important element as we put together new guidance, which would largely, I assume, integrate the guidance in those 2 standards. again, an important area we'd address in these standards would be required procedures when an auditor uses pricing services in audits of fair values. This has been another area that's been a matter of significant discussion among the audit profession and my office and inspectors, especially during the last couple of years, in the area of difficulty in obtaining fair values and the increased reliance on pricing services in that regard. And so we intend to specifically address our pricing services as part of this project. And a third area would be improved procedures regarding the auditor's assessment of and response to risk relating to fair value estimates, including the risk of management bias in the determination of fair value, or also the risk of material misstatement due to fraud as a result of fair value measurements. As indicated, the project also includes other accounting estimates as part of the standard setting. In this regard, we'll consider the IAASB approach in its analogous standard, whereby the analogous ISA combines the standards for auditing fair values with the standards for auditing other estimates, and essentially considers fair value as just one of many estimates. We'll consider that approach, although I think there are a number of unique issues with respect to fair values that will certainly have a fair amount of debate as to whether or not to follow that approach or have separate standards pertaining to auditing fair value measurements. If there are no comments, the next item on the standard setting agenda goes to part of the audit performed by other auditors, or principal auditor, as it's often referred to. Another area where there have been numerous inspection findings, and as I referenced earlier, we had the need to issue Practice Alert 6 after a discussion with the SAG, which specifically addressed situations where U.S. auditors were issuing reports where the bulk of the work was done by other auditors in other countries, where the bulk of the issuer's activities were in those other countries, and the U.S. auditor was not following the audit guidance in existing standards. Some of the key matters that will be addressed in this standard setting project, including the matter that I just referred to, include the decision by an auditor as to whether or not he or she can serve as the principal auditor, and enhance guidance in that area. Provisions strengthening the principal auditor's requirements for evaluating the competence and the independence of the other auditor. The extent of the principal auditor's involvement in the planning and reviewing of the work of other auditors. Requirements regarding communications between the principal auditor and the other auditor. And as I mentioned also, considerations whether or not the other auditor has been inspected by the PCOB and how the principal auditor should take that into account in the use of the work of the other auditor. So this, again, is another large and what I'll call very important standard-setting initiative. We plan to issue a proposed standard for public comment on this item in the first quarter of 2011. It sounds like that quarter is getting loaded up with a lot of items. Turning the page, number 10 on this page is quality control standards. Deficiencies in audits such as those recently indicated in the 4010 report and audits inspected during the economic crisis raise questions about quality controls at audit firms. They also raise a question in my mind for us to look at our existing quality control standards to determine if they're satisfactory. So in this regard, we're having a discussion with the SAG on this matter later today to get your input with respect to a system of quality control. And our goal is to issue a concept release pertaining to quality control standards in the second quarter of 2011. The project will also address not only the existing interim quality control standards, but as many of you are aware, I'm sure, the board also adopted certain requirements of the SEC practice section, which only applied to firms who were part of the SEC practice section in 2002, adopted those SEC PS standards as part of the interim standards. So this project will include integrating the requirements of the SEC practice section standards into our quality control standards as well. Question from Arnold Schilder.
Marty, it was a brief comment when you were with Fair Value. You mentioned that Fair Value measurements have some unique elements. That's very true, of course. Maybe it's of interest to know that the IAASB just 2 weeks ago approved an exposure draft of a practice statement, IPS 1000. That task force was led by John Fogarty, and that is titled Auditing Complex Financial Instruments. It's a practice statement, as said, but it elaborates on the specifics of auditing complex financial instruments and therefore fair values and all the elements that you mentioned. So that is an illustration of the very right point, that it's a very unique topic. And, of course, we benefited from your input in that project as well. And now I have the floor on the question of Dennis Beresford, service organizations. We published standard assurance standard 3402 on that topic of service organization last December, and we promised that we would review experience with that standard in 2013, as it is a rather new area, and we made sure that there was a lot of alignment with the revised SAS 70 again, on the project, we benefited from the active observership of the PCOB in our deliberations. Thank you.
Thanks, Arnold, for those comments. And as Arnold mentioned, the IAASB did ask us if we were interested in participating in the project on fair value and complex financial instruments. And a senior member of my staff did participate on that. We reviewed that document, and I think that document provides valuable additional guidance. Lynn Turner.
Marty, when I was, first of all, the presentation is most helpful and very, very good. As I was looking through all the materials, though, I wasn't quite certain about one area, and that relates back to the issue of transparency and the PCOB and what it's doing with respect to the Treasury Committee safe recommendations in that area. Treasury recommendation included some stuff about additional transparency reporting by the firms, including on audit quality factors. And of course, as you know, during the investor advisory group meeting, the issue of disclosure of audit quality factors also came up. I think you note that in one of your documents here. But it looks like the PCOB isn't doing anything on that, which I find somewhat surprising and somewhat concerning, because the PCOB is the overseer for the firms, and if it isn't getting that data, including the financial information, it's tough to understand how you could see if these firms are facing a financial difficulty or not, and would be subject to severe criticism if something popped up with the firms when, in fact, 8 years after your creation, you weren't even getting financial information and data from these firms. Could you elaborate any more about what the board is thinking or what the staff is thinking in terms of improving transparency, including in the area of audit quality factors?
I'll start first on audit quality indicators, and if it's all right, maybe I'll ask Dan if you could comment a little bit when I'm completed on transparency, which is a recommendation in the ACAP. There was a SAG discussion a couple of years ago, as I noted, on audit quality indicators. And we've continued to do research in this area, and both on audit quality indicators in terms of input factors, what goes into the audit as an audit quality indicator, as well as output factors in terms of the quality of the audit, because it can be measured by a number of things, and whether or not measuring restatements or other matters is a way to look at audit quality after the fact. There's a significant debate, I think, on whether input or output are more important factors, whether they're both important, or whether they both could have been unintended consequences if reported and measured. Certainly one concern that was expressed at the SAG meeting some couple of years ago was if an output factor in terms of the rate or number of restatements became an indicator of audit quality, would that have the unintended consequences of encouraging an audit partner on a close call to say, I don't think we really need to make this restatement given how it's going to show up in our statistics? So a lot of complicated issues in this. I mentioned also that IOSCO has a project. They had a paper out and asked for comment on that. And we've been talking to representatives of IOSCO about their efforts in this regard. I believe, Arnold, I don't know if you want to comment further later on this as well, but the IAASB has considered audit quality indicators. So it's on our radar screen. We're continuing to do research in the area. We don't quite feel ready in terms of recommending something to the board that we think we have something that we think is ready for prime time to be put out in terms of a proposal. So, again, we're monitoring. It's on our radar screen and has our consideration. Dan, I don't know if you'd like to comment further or comment on Lynn's comments regarding transparency reporting by firms.
Well, there's not much I can add. I'm just in terms of the catastrophic failure issue, I mean, as I think the ACAP update indicates, and the inspection group does try to look at litigation exposure of the firm and how that might affect its stability. Again, as the report indicates, we haven't taken any action, at least to date, on the idea of getting financial statements from the firm, I guess. Again, at least from my personal perspective, we've approached the ACAP recommendations more in a priority area of the things that would seem to have an impact on the audit process and on audit quality initially. And certainly the risk of a firm failure is, I guess, one of the many things that keeps me up awake at night. It's certainly very much on I think, all of our minds, and perhaps this is something that we'll have to address in the future.
Not totally related to your comment, but maybe tangentially, Lynn, or your observation, I did mention, although not on our standard setting agenda now, we are having regular discussions with the board, and we're watching observations by our inspections division, who are closely monitoring non-audit services performed by audit firms, and whether or not any the increase in those services, including increases with respect to audit clients, could be impacting audits. So again, dealing with firms' financial performance, we think we've all observed an increase, or firms talking about increasing some of their non-audit services, making acquisitions in that area, et cetera. So that's on our screen as well. Arnold Schilder?
Briefly on audit quality. This is a topic that really has the interest of yourselves and us jointly, and we had a very lively and interesting discussion privately with the PCOB in June. Our planning is to discuss a draft thought piece, as we call it, in our December board meeting, that then would be published, and that would highlight important elements that contribute to audit quality. And of course, an important part of that is the input side that has to come from auditors, including standards, etc. But there's also a message, probably, that the outputs and communications are very important. So in driving audit quality upwards, the responses from users and audit committees are very important there, contribute a lot as well. And to complete the triangular relationship, as we sometimes call it, also the relationship with regulators, for that matter. So it's basically calling upon all these various stakeholders to take their role in bringing audit quality higher up. And as I said, we hope to publish that in January, if you're agreeing on that. Thank you.
Thanks, Arnold. Barbara Roper.
Just very briefly, I wanted to say that I'm pleased to hear that auditor independence is on your radar screen. It's my reading of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act that it does anticipate that the board would periodically monitor, you know, in an ongoing fashion, issues related to independence. I don't have any specific concerns to raise, but I think it's sort of overdue, or at least very timely issue for the board to be looking at.
Thanks, Barbara. Neri Buxban.
Thank you, Chairman. Just an observation relating to audit quality and measurement, and perhaps also going to the topic of some of the elements that were referred in your report on the audit finding arising from the recent crisis. And perhaps speaking a little bit from my own experience, the notion of measurement, sometimes not a single measure can give you the precise measure. I think the issue is the confluence of measures, understanding the outcome, and the fact that you have a single measure that could perhaps in some circumstances could produce some counterintuitive results or may incent different behavior does not always seem to lend you to a decision that you shouldn't be measuring it, but rather it's how you deal with the observations. So I encourage the board to think about that, because this could be an outcome of almost every single measure that will be discussed in the context of quality. The other element that seems to be somewhat either a missing element in the finding, in my perspective, and feeds to this particular area, is the why. There's a lot of discussion about finding, but there's not much discussion of a root cause. And I think root cause could be quite important in understanding how you drive the next improvements in your standard setting process as well as in the quality process. So I don't know how much your process lends itself to the WISE as part of the findings, but it clearly was not summarized in some of the reports that have been shared with us, and I think those WISE are quite critical in allowing us or everyone that is involved to understand how the system can be improved.
Thanks, Neri. Those are both very good observations. With respect to audit quality, I certainly agree. I don't think we'll ever come down to one statistic that's going to say this is the silver bullet that measures audit quality, and it probably is a number of factors regarding what goes into the audit that influences audit quality, and certainly then what comes out of the audit. Measuring what comes out of that audit, though, in terms of one audit versus another, and the quality of that is certainly a challenge. Sometimes aspects of an audit only reveal themselves over time when one finds out that financial statements have been misstated for a number of years. So important observations. Again, as I said, we're continuing to think about this topic. It's a challenging one. We do know that a lot of people are interested in this subject, and we have it on our radar screen and staying close to what others are doing as well. Your second other point is also a good one, and the importance of root cause analysis in terms of audit failures and audit deficiencies, and why do they occur, or in some cases why do they recur, is an important matter. And with respect to at least our inspections, as we think about standard setting, we talk to our inspections division about their perceptions about what the causes are. So I think there's more work to be done in this regard by us, but I think it's an important element, and I think you've hit the ball right in the center with that comment as well. Galen Hansen.
Thanks, Marty. I just wanted to follow up on a couple things. Certainly this area of audit quality metrics has been debated, and I think Arnold mentioned that there's an IAASB project that is addressing that, and I think it'd be important on an ongoing basis to monitor that, as I know you are. With respect to that, a couple PCOB or SAG meetings back, there was a discussion about cost-cutting, fee-cutting, and I think in the discussion that we're going to have this afternoon, hopefully we're going to be able to talk about that a little bit, because I think that is an important element of the quality control system. And I know that the PCOB has taken some steps along those lines in terms of monitoring. I wonder if you might be able to comment on that. And then to pick up on Lynn's comment on transparency, I'm reading the ACAP recommendation number 7, and it says that the larger firms were going to be required to file confidential audited financial statements with the PCOB. Has anything been done on that? I didn't hear any comment on it during the discussion.
So first on your comments on audit quality, again, I think you joined in terms of the chorus of people saying continue to keep this on our radar screen and see what we can do. Certainly working with any input from the firms I think would be valuable to us too, as to how the firms measure their audit quality, and that would be an important consideration, I think, in terms of clearly articulating in any transparency reports firms issue regarding audit quality would be an important thing for us to hear about in any such transparency reports. Fees were a discussion, and we continue to have that discussion as the firms periodically come in and talk to the board, talk to my office. We've raised the question of fee pressure, and it's certainly been observed in the past year. To the extent we make inquiries about it, the point is clearly also made that it can't influence the quality of work the auditor does, notwithstanding the fact that they agree to negotiate lower fees. We are it's an important matter that inspections is aware of. You could certainly talk to this afternoon. We can talk to Helen Munter and Paul Bijou about any observations they may have. But inspectors certainly have it on their radar screen in doing an inspection of an audit to look in cases where audit fees have been reduced and the extent to which that may have influenced any changes or inappropriate changes in the audit. Our Office of Research and Analysis continues to do work in this area as well, putting together statistics and outliers for us to take a look at and for inspections to look at where they see where audit fees have reduced substantially as potentially an audit that might have unique risks that should be inspected, and also bringing that information to the aggregates of that information to my office as well for us to consider in terms of any our standard setting. So the fee reduction pressure area is certainly something that's also on our radar screen. I think finally on transparency, I thought Dan responded to that with respect to the fact that at this point in time, reports are not being received with respect to audited financial statements, for instance, are not being received. The inspections division certainly, as part of its inspections, has the ability, though, to see financial statements at the firms as part of their, and financial information at the firms as part of their inspection process. Lynn Turner.
Marty, back to that point, what Damon was raising. I think there is a significant difference, though, between what you were articulating and what the Treasury Committee was articulating. What I just heard from you is that the board, and most appropriately so, is looking at audit quality as it should, as it does its inspections. And as Dan said, watching the litigation exposure. But what the recommendations of the Treasury Committee was trying to drive at was transparency. And there's nothing transparent about that process that you just described whatsoever. It certainly informs the board and the staff and can be generate data that can be very helpful in determining or assessing what should or should not be transparent. But at the end of the day, the Treasury recommendation was all about making this stuff transparent to the public. And I think what concerns me is what I'm hearing from the board here is there's no intent to go that next step and make that information transparent, which is, in fact, then saying, no, we're not going to do the Treasury Committee recommendation. And that would be concerning to me if I understood that is where you're at.
Well, maybe I should just say no decision like that has been made. I guess I've said I would have to concede if that's the word. We haven't taken action on that recommendation, but we certainly haven't concluded not to pursue that recommendation. I guess that's a fair statement. As I tried to say before, at least for myself, I've tried to approach these things in the order in which I at least saw them as affecting audit quality. In my own mind, there aren't any that I've said I would not pursue under any circumstances. I appreciate the point that inaction is a kind of action, but there's no decision not to take up any of these things.
Damon Silvers.
Not to torment Dan further on this, but I will. as you know, I mean, as a participant in that process, there was a fair amount of attention given to this issue of audit of financial statements for the large audit firms at the time that the Treasury's Advisory Committee worked. Can you share with us at all the board's thinking or your thinking or staff's thinking on this particular issue? It's anomalous, I would say, given the sort of central role of the large audit firms in our public securities markets, and given how much I think this issue of firm failure is on the minds of policymakers. It's anomalous that the critical data is secret. That that bothers me. It bothered me at the time of the committee. On the other hand, that's been a true fact about our financial system for as long as we've had a financial system. And so I'm just curious what, you know, to the extent, obviously knowing you haven't made a decision, to the extent that you can share any of the board's or the staff's thinking about this issue, as you ponder whether to make a decision, that would be, I think, interesting to us.
Well, I think really the only thing I can add is that, again, just from my personal perspective, it begins to raise larger questions about what our role is for the safety and soundness of accounting firms versus our role for the quality of the work that they prepare and give to the public. And I'm not sure that I myself have fully thought that through. I mean, nothing has been done really tangibly with respect to the recommendations relating to firm catastrophic failure and putting in place some sort of a system that would address